All right, make sure. Yeah, we're recording, so I'm going to start. Y'all ready?
Ready.
Ready.
Welcome to Stories with Briscoe and Bradshaw. That's Briscoe. I'm Bradshaw, and we are thrilled today. One of the biggest what-ifs stories in the history of this business. But what's so cool about this is he was such a big name that 35 years after his last match, when he put out on social media, you're going to talk to Magnum TA, people go nuts. That's how big this character is and this person is. Magnum, welcome to the show.
And it's a pleasure to be here with you guys.
Look, I want to get started with something very serious, if I can, because we've talked a lot about in Florida and the Florida territories, the Briscoes there. Anybody who's come on this show has said one thing. Fighting for that T-shirt on the side of the road was one thing, but Magnum TA is the best beer drinker not named Andre in the history of this business. How much beer can you actually drink?
Well, you know, the thing of it is you know, I was a young man, and I didn't know that it was supposed to be things that were outside the norm. You know, we just, you know, I'd been having a good time, you know, for years driving up down the road with Andre sometimes too in Portland, Oregon when I started. So I didn't know, you know, being able to drink 20, 25, 30 beers, you know, on a road trip back in a couple hours was a big deal. Cause that's just what we did. And so, you know, I get down there and I meet, you know, Jack and Jerry and then all of a sudden I hear about this leader of the pack thing that's so infamous. And they start telling me the stories about it and how Jimmy Garvin was the reigning leader of the pack and this, that, and the other, blah, 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 blah. And I said, well, you know, I guess we'll just see what we see. And so the deal was, you know, if you challenge for the shirt, and you could challenge anytime, any day. You didn't get like a day off.
It's like 24/7 title, right? Right. The Terry is like that hardcore 24/7 title. You can challenge anytime.
Exactly. So, you know, and they would use that against you because obviously if you were peaking every night, if you're hitting 28 to 32 to 35 beers a night, you're getting a little thin in the skin, you know. And then to top it all off, at the end of it, if you were challenging the champion and maybe he did outdrink you. Well then, or you outdrank him, you could challenge for a takedown. You could have one takedown to see who could get control at the tail end of it, wherever you met parked up that night. So Jimmy and I had our deal and I was in pretty good shape. So I put him away pretty significantly and he wasn't feeling too good, but he did challenge me for that takedown. And at Turkey, he got out and we were in front of the Days Inn down there in Tampa. And he shot before I was even knew he was coming. And I grabbed him by two handfuls of hair and plowed his beak right down through the grass and made a little plow mark with him. And he submitted and it was all over. It was good. But it was the deal. And just so the legend is even more.
Oh, relevant, man.
This is the infamous shirt.
And it's
stained and it's got a sewed up place here on the back where it got ripped one time and put it back together.
And we could grab shirts and stuff like that. And it's a good thing that mile marker there, but Jimmy might have had you if I recall right. He was in on you, but you healed out like you said. You grabbed that tight end and Jimmy. Now, you know, he's clean shaven. But back in those days, Jimmy had a head of hair on him out to here, right, Terry?
Oh, it was a handle. But you don't know the rest of the story. See, he got, and then he healed me back out of the title with Brian Blair. They fudged me and they were sharing beers and throwing ones out and got lost account. So years and years and years later, after my accident in, this is like 1990 something. Bobby Fulton comes over and gets me one night. He said, let's go get that shirt. And he takes me over to Jimmy's house and Jimmy wasn't prepared. We come in with a case of beer, throw it down on the counter and said, it's on, you're defending. And I sat there, I drank three-fourths of the case of beer and he drank one and called it a day and he gave me the shirt and I retired.
You know, that shirt is like the Holy Grail. That's the first time I've ever seen it. I mean, that is like a mythical creature professional wrestling.
No, this has been through three marriages and divorces. And and I mean, it's the only real memorabilia that matters about anything. And I've managed to hold on to it.
I hope that shirt wasn't the cause of those three marriages.
Well, yeah, I'm not going to. I'm not going to
maybe
say
one.
What went with anything, but you know,
yeah,
I'm proud of it.
Jerry,
yeah, that shirt. I mean, you know, I can't, you know, how many guys, Manny Fernandez, you know, I mean, everybody that come through, El Grand Apollo, you know, everybody challenged for that shirt. And Terry's the leader of the pack, man.
You know, was that your last battle with Garvin? That was the last, and it
was appropriate because my last match in the ring was with Jimmy. Jimmy and I were in a feud here, and we had a lumberjack match the night that I had the accident that ended it all. And then I came back a couple of years later and got the real championship from him in the title of the leader of the pack. Because, I mean,
the real championship.
Yeah. I mean, the 10 pounds of gold and all that stuff was just loose. Yeah. This was a shoot. Yeah.
That is one of the most talked about shirts in the history of this business. It's
well, exciting. Now you know where it's at, but don't try to challenge me. I, if you come to my door, I'm not letting you in.
I heard too much about you to challenge you. Talk about marriages. Jerry Briscoe was supposed to be a groomsman in my wedding, and he called me up and he said, "John, I'm sorry. My kid made the state tournament," and he said, "I can't make your wedding." I said, "Of course not, Jerry. Go to your kid's wrestling match." And he said, "I promise I'll be a groomsman in your next wedding, too."
And you know what? That's the same thing Dusty told me one time. So I know exactly where that comes from.
When you talk about
speaking of which, Terry, I mean, when you came to Florida, man, you know, you were young, but I you know, I would tell at least how you got to Florida. And you were out and out in Oregon, out on the West Coast, I believe, because when you come in, that's what we heard. We heard you were the shooter from Oregon's coming in to challenge you guys.
Well, here's the deal. So
and you were state champion in Virginia, went to Old Dominion University. Yeah. Did you play ball there and wrestle? Or?
No, the school I went to only didn't have a football team. They had soccer, basketball, and wrestling. And I wasn't going down any of those other avenues. And wrestling ended up being my thing, and I was a big Dan Gable fan. So,
and now let me, I'm going to jump in here real quick. Then I'm not going to jump in again for a while. But John, I don't know the story. Tell the story about what your mom did and what inspired you to become a state champion.
So I'm an only child and I wasn't a natural athlete by any stretch of the imagination. I was just an average kid, but my mom got me Dan Gable's book after he'd won the 72 Olympics. And I read that book. And it like lit a fire in me. And I went from like the old Charles Atlas, comic, the little skinny kid to get sand kicked in his face, in the ninth grade to I pinned everybody I wrestled my senior year and won the state championship. And Gable's story inspired me to the point that I had this drive and this ambition. And it's the reason I went to Waterloo, Iowa, was to tell him the story. What a huge, inspiration he'd been in my life. And I know he's inspired, you know, thousands and thousands of people. But for me, he was John Wayne and all that rolled into one as far as the impact, you know, he had on me personally.
What kind of reaction did he give you when you told him that story?
You could tell it touched him. And I explained, I said, I drove a long way to get here and I went around my elbow to get to my thumb, but I'd do it all again to have a chance to just see you eyeball to eyeball one time and tell you what you meant to me and how much you inspired me in my lifetime.
And one of the reasons you drove was because the Segway that you use to get around, you can't take on planes, right? So you end up driving all the way out to Waterloo, Iowa, and you took a little circle route to get there, correct?
Yeah, I was following Siri. I was following my Siri, had the iPhone, and I was going across the country. And I didn't even think about the fact that there was more than one Waterloo. I just thought Waterloo was out west somewhere. And there couldn't be more than one of them. And that was stupid. I'm lucky I didn't end up in Alaska or something. I mean, you know, there's just no telling. But, I was talking. I actually pulled up to a lady on the street and asked her where the convention center was. And she was like saying, "We don't have a convention center like that." I'm going, "Man, I know, I got the right event." And then I realized I was in the complete wrong state. But I did make it across. It's about I'd only driven 1,600 miles. What was 200-300 more? You know, it didn't really matter.
How did you end up getting started in Portland? I guess you're out there in 78 and 79. Is that right? And Piper was out there then, right? Along with
I graduated high school in 77. And I went to a year and a half of college at Old Dominion University in Norfolk, Virginia. I broke in 1980 in Portland. And what happened, I met Buzz Sawyer when he was in Mid-Atlantic. And Buzz, like, because the kayfabe was so heavy back then, you know, nobody really like talked to you, tell you what's what. But he met me because I was bouncing in nightclubs. And the clubs I came to, Virginia Beach, Rugs Gallery and Peabody's. So he like kind of like takes me off to the side and says, hey, you know, I can do this, that, and the other, blah, 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 blah. And long story short, some things happened that weren't real ethical, but he left and went to Portland. And he said, hey, I'm going to go get things set up for you to start. But if you go pick my little brother, Brett, up down in Tampa, take him to Mid-South, I'll call you. So I do. I drive from Virginia to Tampa, pick up Brett, take him to New Orleans and Shreveport. And I drove him and some of the other guys around for about a month, went to all the matches, haven't had a first match, haven't done a tie-up, a wrist lock, wrist watch, no nothing at this point in time. And I can't get a hold of Buzz. Buzz is like unavailable. So one day I tell Jimmy Garvin my story about what had happened. He said, well, I'll tell you what. He said, if I were you, he said, I'd get in that car of yours and I'd drive out there and go be on his doorstep. And that's what I did. Unannounced, Buzz opens the door, Portland, Oregon. I found out his address, found out his apartment number, beat on the door, opens it up. I said, I'm here, I'm ready to go. So
what did he say?
He said, okay. And and the silver-tongued devil that he is, he goes into Don, tells Don, hey, I got this young guy. He's been working down there for Bill in Mid-South. I haven't worked a lick. I don't own a pair of boots or a pair of tights.
You hadn't even been in a ring, have you?
I've never been in a ring. So, So he sells it to Don. He takes me down to the bowling alley where they filmed. And him and I and Princess Victoria worked out in the ring for a solid 2 hours. He taught me how to hit the ropes, how to grab a headlock, how to take a tackle, how to take an arm drag, how to give an arm drag. 2 hour workout. The very next night, I'm on live television wrestling Buzz. And never look back. That was it. That was my indoctrination. I worked 7 days a week from then on out and learned it all in the ring.
Well, that sounds real similar to the way I broke in at Jack's dining room. He showed me a couple of headlock and a wrist lock and, you know, how to take a bump. And the next night I was in the ring against the Leroy McGurk's tag team champions, Jack and I, because his partner got hurt. So, you know, it's funny how things work out like that. But after you, who was your first match? Who did they put you with?
So my very first match was Buzz. And wow. It was with Buzz. So I'd worked out in the ring with him.
Damn him.
So him and I mean, we went out there and had about an 8-10 minute match. And like I said, I've never done anything anywhere. And I'm on TV and nobody ever got smartened up to it. So I just, yeah, but you know, it was like, I didn't know the lingo. Like 3 weeks in the business, I'm working with Gene Kaninsky in Seattle. You know, big Gene, big rough, rugged guy, right?
Was he champion at the time?
No, he wasn't the champion, but it wasn't that long since he'd been the champion. So I'm in there with Gene. Gene picks me up, drops me behind him, tells me to roll him up. I don't know what a roll up is. I belly to back suplexed him on his head. And he popped. He came in the back. He said, man, that was exciting. I didn't know what we were doing. I said, I didn't know either. I didn't know what a roll up was. I thought that's something you did in the kitchen when you're making something to eat.
Did you learn one?
I might have learned a couple of those things along the line.
Were you out there? How was Piper out there? Were you out there with Roddy?
No, Roddy was not there then. I mean, it was like Dutch Savage was the booker, and Jay Youngblood was there, and the Barbarian. He was just breaking into, and oh Lord. You know, he's 280-pound, you know, Samoan, and him and I are both green as could be, and they put us out there for 20-minute Broadways, like as a rib to see which one of us is going to live, you know? And, you know, it was Matt Borden was there, his dad, Tough Tony Bourne, gosh, it's hard. Like I said, it's hard to remember, but I was only there 6 months, but I met Andre there because I had the big, I had a big car. I had this old 98 diesel four door. So when Andre came, we had the big car, drove, you know, drove the giant around. And so him and I got to be friends there. And that started something that led to something really big in my career when I got to Florida. But
did you take Elton Owens money when you was he still doing that deal where you'd slip a guy's a few dollars to shoot on each other?
Oh yeah, $30. You get an extra $30 if you did the shoot. Wow. And then we'd split the shoot, you know, and so yeah. we'd make a better payoff. But I worked with Matt
Boyd.
John,
you know the story there. Elton Owen, Don Owen's brother, he liked really real wrestlers. So if he knew he'd come over, hey, I'll give you an extra $30, $40 if you'll go out and you'll take this guy down. You know, of course, he wouldn't smarten up the other guys. So, you know, after a while, the guy just started smartening up each other. Hey, I get the $30 tonight, we'll split it. So they got an extra payoff for that. And exactly. Owens never knew they were working him.
When we were working for Otto and Peter in Europe, it's very much similar, same thing. The referee would fine the babyface and give him a fine like $50 or $75 or something. And some fan would always come up and pay the fine. So the more heated a match would get, you know, sometimes it might be several hundred dollars in fines. We weren't making much money. And, of course, we split it with the referee and the other guy. It was all the boys always find out a way to work anything.
Oh my gosh. But you know, to get me over to Florida, I got to give you one more hop. So I was 6 months there working full time. And somehow I got a call from somebody. They wanted me to go to LA. And I wasn't real hip on LA. The vibe just didn't feel right. And I got a hold of Joe Blanchard. And Joe brought me into his territory, and I got some really good experience there. It was some amazing hands there. And now, you know, I knew a little bit, I mean, 6 months in the business, but seven nights a week, 6 months in the business was a lot more, you know, than, you know, a lot of these guys get today. So about 5 months into my tour there in the Southwest, this guy that I've never met before named Mike Graham comes in junior there. I think he was supposed to be the junior heavyweight champion of the world or something, comes in guest spotting. And Mike and I hit it off like we've known each other our entire lives. We go out, we just have big old time tearing up the town together. And he has so much fun with me that he goes back and tells his dad, hey, there's this young guy over in San Antonio that we got to bring in here. He's going to do something, blah, 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 blah. And so he was my stepping stone to get into Florida Championship Wrestling. And that's where my real education started, with Eddie Graham and Dory and the Briscoes and eventually Dusty coming in. That was a huge learning piece for me.
How bad were the Briscoes?
John, Terry said something there in the beginning of this story, you know, that you and I talked about several times. You know, something just didn't feel right about L.A. Remember, we used to talk about the guys on the West Coast, you know, they, you know, San Francisco and L.A., those guys, it was all the way up the coast, all the way to Washington and there. But what was it that just didn't feel right? Just the style, Terry, or what, you know, I mean, yes. I've heard the same thing from many, many guys, right, John? We always hear that.
I saw tapes of them and things they were doing, and it wasn't just, I didn't feel comfortable in just the programming out there and what it looked like. And I didn't see myself growing like I wanted to go, because I mean, from my first week in the business, my ambition was to one day be world champion. That was just it. I didn't get in to be just there. I wanted to be the best one day. And I knew I was going to have to learn a lot to get, you know, even on a, you know, this far up the ladder to make that happen. And I didn't see that as being, you know, moving me in the right direction.
Who was booking then? Because we talked about this before, me and Jerry, you know, Pat Patterson, who's a good friend of Jerry and I both, much better friend of Jerry. would talk about Gorgeous George, and he didn't like people coming out of L.A. You know, he was up big up in San Francisco and even further up in Portland, but there was always that contention between L.A. and then further up. Who was booking then in L.A. that wanted you to come out there? Do you remember?
No, I don't. It seems like
you saw the same thing is what I'm getting at, right?
Yeah, I did. And it, like I said, it just didn't feel right. And I had driven up the coast. When I went to Portland, I drove all the way across the United States and then straight up the coast to Portland. And it was just the people, the everything about that area. You know, I'm an East Coast guy. I'm country from out on the farms, and it just didn't jive in that whole scene whatsoever. I just felt out of my element.
How bad were the Briscoes payoffs?
The Briscoes.
Okay, well, now you're in Florida. Now that's where he gets.
Now shoot. Well, I mean, when I came to work there, Dory was the booker, and I mean, you know, Mike and Eddie. I mean, they took care of me. I blew my knee out while I was down there, and they paid for the surgery, took care of everything, made sure I had enough, hamburger and beer money to survive until I could get back in the ring, which I think I did in about 2 weeks after, you know, orthoscopic surgery. And it was just, you know, every night I got to travel with Eddie for about the first several months I was there, fly on the plane with him. And he was in my ear every night. I'd watch the matches with him from the back. He just taught me so much about psychology, about the difference in registering something and selling it and then dying. You know, the differences and all the things you need to do to paint the picture, to tell the story. So I had just this, you know, flood of information coming in, besides the fun and the parties and everything we did, you know, late night. From the time I got to that arena till we left, it was just, I was soaking it up like a sponge. And Eddie was just phenomenal. I mean, Mike didn't ever talk to me about psychology, about anything, but how to chase a skirt. And I love Mike to death. He was like, he was older than me, but he was like a little brother rather than a big brother. But his dad was just, he was, you know, like a professor of the business. And it was amazing.
You know, that's one of the things that people talk about today. You know, you know, the learning that you do in the car, you know, that's how we learn the business. You know, you talk about the matches, but we didn't have anything else to do. You know, now they have all these iPhones, they have all the social media, they have all this stuff. We didn't have any of that. We just had each other. And that's why some of the ribs got so crazy, some of the stories got so crazy, because we had to be our own entertainment.
Well, thank God they didn't, or we wouldn't have made it. Because if they'd recorded any of that stuff, we'd all been locked up or, you know, something. I mean, it wouldn't have ended well.
And a promoter, no other promoter would have you after what we did down there. I mean, Terry, you and you know, in the ring, you got good really quick. I mean, that mind of yours, you had to be focused on all the outside distractions that my brother and I presented you. I mean, we could tell in the car. I mean, your mind was always on the sport. And you had that passion right from the very beginning, and you got so good real quick. John, I can't tell you this guy come in and, you know, we heard Mike and told us the story, you know, he hadn't worked much and, you know, he was a rookie, but like he said, once Eddie takes you under that wing and puts his arm around you and starts whispering in your ear, it's like you're getting a gift, man. You're getting a gift. You're learning so much knowledge. And you're learning so much psychology of the match and of the people and what the fans are expecting from you, right, Terry? I mean, this guy was his word was gospel.
It was, and the believability factor and the intensity that was my career that I molded my character around was that believability thing. I didn't care about, you know, being able to do the most acrobatic thing in the world. I didn't care about anything, but people believing when they walked out of the building that I was for real and that I had really presented a contest and they'd been in that contest with me because you brought them into the story. They were in the struggle. I mean, I can't tell you, John, how many matches that Dusty booked me in with Brad Armstrong as my partner or Scotty McGee, where we went out and did 45 minutes with the Kangaroos, and and to to fight from the bottom up, you know, for 20, 30 minutes in a match is the hardest work, you know, I ever did. But you learn the psychology of how to keep those people coming and wanting it. So when that, you know, that end, that pop came, you know, they were ready for it. It was like huge.
You know, one thing that I saw that you've done an interview, you talked about the fact that when you first met Tully Blanchard, Tully just wanted to be the best heel alive. That's all he wanted to be. And very few people actually want to be a heel. I know, because I was a heel most of my career. Hot Rod, Roddy used to always tell me, he said, kid, there aren't many people who want to be, they really deep down don't want to be heels. They don't want to be called names going through the airport. They don't want people to sneer at them. They want to kind of be loved. Tully wanted to be a heel. And you just wanted to be the best baby face in the world. You wanted to be world champion. You wanted to be over. Yeah. You didn't care about the, like you say, the flips, the flops, and all that stuff. Not to bash these guys today. These guys, they are awesome. I'm not taking a shot at them.
Yeah.
I'm just talking about how your mindset was, I'm going to be the best in the world at what I do. And that kind of got, when you and Tully got together, that really made that rivalry between you two that ended up lasted 8 months more incredible than ever before because of the believability that went into this.
Yeah. And so to, you know, you couldn't write a screenplay out any better than the way all this happened. So at, you know, after I'm a year and a half in the Florida territory, Dusty's been the booker for the last 8-9 months that I'm there. And Andre one night was eating at Fat Man's Barbecue and he looks over at me and he said, you know, he said, you're doing great. He said, but you need a handle. You need something catchy that people will think of. He said, you kind of look like that guy, that Tom Selleck guy on that TV show. He said, you should be Magnum TA. Okay. And that had a nice ring to it. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know what, you know, where that was going to go. But he was going up to Vince Sr., going back to New York. And his idea was to take me up there to New York, bring me up there as Magnum TA and launch Magnum there. Unbeknownst to him, Ernie Ladd, who was booking for Mid-South, they had just lost Paul to New York. I get a call in the middle of the night when Paul's left from Ernie saying, there's a top spot open. If you want it, come get it, and we'll give you the chance of a lifetime. So before Andre could open the door, I get the call from Bill. I go to work for Bill, whose mentor was Eddie. And Bill was just the next progression in that intensity, believability aspect of me molding this character, this Magnum character, because again, all I knew was a catchy name. I didn't know what I was really going to do with it because I'd never worked on top. I'd worked in the middle of the card. I could talk a little bit, but I wasn't afraid of the mic, but I didn't have a persona to really dig into and, you know, make mine. And it came through, you know, just like, you know, learning the ropes on the road in the car. Just being on the mic and going through different angles and different stuff brought the intensity out more and more. And that's where I honed that character. And it became kind of the lone wolf, the little different kind of baby face, because I was a little rough around the edges. I still sold and had the comebacks and I still fought from the bottom up and did all those things because, I mean, I was 240 pounds. There's a lot of guys that were way bigger than me. So it was very believable to have somebody, you know, get the advantage. It's 300 pounds. And you're, you know, 240, but that character got built there in a year and a half of now main event programs where I learn, you know, the intensities and the things you need to do, the nuances from like Bill Dundee, who was booking, who'd come in from Tennessee, and from Bill himself and a cast of people that were really amazing workers around me. I was able to now take my skill set up. Now I've worked a year and a half on top. So when the door opened again, Barry goes, leaves Dusty high and dry, and goes to New York because he's starving. And Jimmy Crockett and Dusty call me middle of the night. I'm on top now in Mid-South, making over $2,000 a week. And the guys are starving in the Carolinas. But Jimmy gets on the phone with me and says, hey, I'm going to give you the opportunity of a lifetime, the keys, the golden keys right here. I'm going to give you the biggest shot we could ever give anybody if you'll come. And I worked a 6-week notice for Bill. I got browbeat in the meetings every week at the Irish McNeil's Boys Club where we film. and got, you know, told everybody how crazy I was for leaving on top and going to, you know, going out there to work for Jimmy Crockett. And but it all happened for a reason. And it primed what was coming for Tully and I. That was just, you know, magic.
Did you understand culturally what was going on during that time, say in movies? You know, the good guys were no longer wearing the white hat. You know, you had Stallone come along, who was really the antithesis of the good guy hero. He was the bad guy playing the good guy, and people liked that. So he had this anti-hero start developing. You know, that got huge in the Attitude Era with Stone Cold and The Rock. You were 10 years at least before that. Did you see what was happening culturally with how movies and culture was shifting? Or was it just your mindset that, hey, this is what I need as an edge to get over as this babyface?
Well, it's funny because I didn't think about it, but I was being influenced by it. I've got a picture of me, you know, when I first went into the leather jacket gimmick and that look. It all happened because they had done everything they knew how to do with me, from Brooks Brothers suits to punk rock clothes, all this different stuff. And I was going to go back to Florida. Dusty and I had worked out a deal. I was going to come back to Florida, Magnum TA, the Lone Wolf. I went and bought this Harley Davidson motorcycle in Baton Rouge. Jim Duggan and I rode down there and picked it up. I bought a black leather jacket. I rode that motorcycle to the town. People went crazy. I walked in the dressing room that night with the leathers on. People went crazy. I came back to Shreveport because I'm getting ready to go. And Bill looks at me and says, "You're not going anywhere." And so I had a year run now is that, again, heelish looking baby face thing. And I actually wrote a picture to autograph my mom. I said, "Look, Mom, good guys do wear black," because the Chuck Norris movie back then, good guys wear black. I'd remember that catchphrase. And it did. I saw that being something that was kind of edgy, and it, you know, proceeded like me knocking the president of the NWA, Bob Geigel, you know, on his keister, you know, long before, you know, Stone Cold was doing that with Vince and all those things. But I was heading, that character was heading down that road. I wasn't like the one in the little crowd of baby faces all going, you know, with the little 13-year-old girl screaming. I was the serious character that the 18 to 35 year olds looked at and saw something edgy that they could, you know, they could get excited about.
You accomplished something, Terry, that a few people, you were able to escape Bill Watts. And like you said, you know, normally you just have to give 2 weeks out. And Bill was one of these guys. You're my top guy. It's going to take more than 2 weeks to beat you in every town that I got. So you're staying for me for 6 weeks, right? And that was the deal. You stayed those 6 weeks and they beat your ass every damn night just to show you. But I'm surprised he still let you go.
Well, you know, Bill and I had this unique relationship. I'm not sure Bill knew exactly how I was wired, because Bill's the one who taught me how to throw a punch. And that's scary in and of itself. Anybody that's ever got punched by Bill Watts, just working punch, knows that that's, you know, not exactly an artistic thing. But it looks really good. You know, it's solid. And him and I used to stand in the dressing room, and he'd use me to show the other guys how to throw a punch, because he was always all over these guys that bad punches. But then he would trade with me, and I'd give him one just like he gave me. And, you know, he's not going to like go, ooh, you know, he's not going to sell it because I'm just doing it like he did. But it was some kind of mutual respect there. And he really did, you know, help bring me to a new level. And I always give Bill props. I call that my graduate school era before I got the biggest break of my lifetime.
When Bill left Florida, he said, you know, I got my degree at Oklahoma University, but I got my PhD from Eddie Graham at Florida Championship Wrestling. So, you know, you basically did the same thing. You come down here with Eddie, and I mean, and not taking any away from Don and Owens up there, because he was a great teacher and trained so many great competitors up there. But then you get to come down here and get that knowledge from the master himself, Eddie Graham. And then you go back, you go to one of his main disciples, Bill Watts. So you're really blessed with that knowledge and that Eddie Graham. And then you, from there, you go and you get under that learning tree with Dusty Rhodes, who who loved you like a son, man.
He did. And you know, Dusty and I had never met. And he was down in Florida. Of course, Barry was like the chosen one with him, like always, because of Blackjack and their relationship. But Barry was powdered one night, and Dusty and I ended up riding back from Jacksonville or somewhere. And he puts his Frank Sinatra tape in the dash. And I grew up and was very diversified. I was around all kinds of music, different things growing up. I played the guitar from the time I was 8 years old and all these things. And I knew the words to every single song that came out of that thing. And he was like, I was from another planet, because he loved this old, you know, show music. And I knew it all. We were singing and drinking and just having a big old time. And we just formed this bond immediately that was undeniable. And we just became like, you know, brothers from a different mother that instantly. And it remained that way, you know, basically, you know, till the end. So it's pretty crazy.
Terry, I hate to jump around a bit, but you mentioned the Bob Geigel punch. And that came off of a press conference you had with Nikita Koloff, where he jumped over the table and got beat up Nikita, and then ended up getting reprimanded by Bob Geigel and punching the authority figure, you know, way before, like you said, Stone Cold punch Mr. Yeah. McMahon. But Nikita did an interview I saw that online where he talked about the fact he brought your mother to the press conference and you didn't smarten her up.
No.
At all.
At all.
So yeah. What was she thinking when all of a sudden her son gets in a fight?
Well, you know, kayfabe was king back then. And and I didn't smarten anybody up about anything. You know, mother, dad, you know, didn't matter. I mean, if you put two and two together about things after some point in time, you know, I never insulted anybody's intelligence, but I never said anything. So Dusty gets the idea because he'd shot this video. Dusty always liked me to be like, you know, this lonely guy that, you know, that was like unobtainable kind of person, but wanted me to have this soft spot and know that I had this relationship with my mom. So he shot this video back before I wrestled Flair in one of our go rounds, and with my mom and I on the beach and me training and all this stuff. So he said, it'd be great for your mom to be there when we do this signing. So they bring her in from Chesapeake, Virginia into Charlotte. And no, we don't tell her anything. And she's terrified of Nikita. I mean, he's just, you know, he's 290 pounds and looks like, you know, fire coming out of his eyeballs and Uncle Ivan and, you know, the whole deal. And so, you know, we, you know, of course we had our deal all figured out, and she comes in, sits down in her chair and they're doing it. And Sandy Scott was doing the commentating, the signing. And we had this key word that he was going to say, we were going to let it loose. And man, I came over that table and my mom sold it like an Academy Award winning actress. Like she, we could not have told her that was going to happen. And her reacted the way she did. I mean, she was just flabbergasted, shocked, didn't know what to do. I mean, it, you know, it's out there on YouTube somewhere, but it was, it was amazing. And you know what? I don't even think I smartened her up after it was over. Because they left the room and I was selling. They stomped a mud hole in me before it was all over with. And we, you know, everybody left. And yeah, I don't know how long. I'm not sure I smartened her up until I had the wreck. To be honest, I really don't know.
We've all had, you know, different angles and different storylines, and it's tough, you know, now, especially today, because everything happens in lightning speed, you know, when you have so many different wrestling shows and you have multiple shows per week. But it's tough to go, say, pay-per-view, another pay-per-view, and a third pay-per-view, which you do in big angles, big storylines. By the time you get to the third, you've done almost everything you can do. You went 8 months with Tully Blanchard. How in the world did you guys get almost two-thirds of a year out of that angle?
They knew we hated each other. I mean, the people, I mean, he used Baby Doll as perfect distraction and JJ in different ways, but it became just such a personal deal. The same people that saw me beat Wahoo McDaniels, who was legend for the U.S. title in Charlotte, North Carolina, in the Coliseum, saw Tully screw me out of the title with a roll of quarters that a Baby Doll dressed up as a police officer comes down, slips in the quarters. Nobody sees it. He hits me. Quarters go everywhere. And it was so eerie. There was like 10,000 plus people there, and it was at white heat because I sold it for 10 minutes. I didn't wiggle. I didn't move. He got the 1, 2, 3. He didn't know I was going to get out of the building. It was horrifying. So the heat started off so great that it was just the battles that ensued and the things we did afterwards, and Dusty kept it alive on TV with all kinds of different things and different distractions he made to keep it from coming down to that contest. But, you know, it was because, like you said, no social media. We were able to take it around the whole United States. And we had as brutal of matches, or better maybe, that weren't inside of the cage and weren't with the I quit, you know, stigma to go along with it, but all over the United States. So Tully and I weren't really thinking about the fact that we were doing anything historic, because this is what we did. You know, him and I did that 7 days a week. We'd beat the crap out of each other, fought out in the crowd, you know, juice every night. I mean, just, you know, just blood, guts, and gore, and you know, get it again. You know, we didn't even talk to each other. We knew each other so well. I don't even know what calling a spot was after 8 months of that, because we just, it was like, you know, Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. We knew what we were doing.
That's a great feeling. That's a great feeling, Ed and Terry, where you just react instead of thinking about what's going on. And it's a reaction. But you mentioned something earlier. John and I have talked about a lot of times, and it's that white heat where the building just goes quiet on you and it's just still. And you're laying there, or you're on top, and you're thinking, man, this is it. I mean, you have one more move, and you don't know what's going to happen, whether it's going to be a full-scale riot or what. But there's nothing like that feeling, is there, brother?
No, and it's not. And it's the most addicting adrenaline rush of anything I've ever been a part of. I try to tell people, you know, they say, oh, why didn't you get caught up in this or get caught up in that? Because performing for me was the high. That being part of going out, you know, not just to tear the house down, but leave, you know, I wanted people walking out the building talking about it, going, oh my gosh, you know, talking about it, you know, or at break time the next day at work. I wanted people talking about it because they couldn't figure out for the life of how somebody didn't end up going to the emergency room, you know, how we were still alive after what took place.
Does it amaze you that, you know, most wrestling fans, I don't know what the average age is. You know, wrestling really is a cross section. You know, you go to a show, you might have a stockbroker sitting next to just a regular worker that's in a factory. You know, there's really a cross section of wrestling fans. And I'm not sure the age demo that is an actual, say, the typical median age of a wrestling fan. But that was over 35 years ago. Most wrestling fans, I would assume, were not even alive then. But when they talk about great cage matches, they always talk about the I Quit match. Does it amaze you that that match now, 35 years ago, is still being talked about in such reverential terms? Did you know at that time when you walked out of that, that was a freaking masterpiece?
I felt it was something magic happened. The only time I really realized it was at the end. At the end, when I had him by the head and I had that god-awful looking spike, like they didn't know whether I was going to drive it through his head and literally leave him there with a poking out his head or what was going to happen. It was like I knew we'd put the period on it. I knew it was done, but I didn't know it was going to be relevant, you know, 30-some years later. No, I had no earthly inclination, because again, to me, it got captured because it was pay-per-view, and we did so much, and Jack and Jerry, same thing. They, so many classic things happened over the course of, you know, decades that nobody ever captured because it wasn't filmed. You know, can you imagine all the amazing matches like Harley Race and Dory and Jack, and I mean, just these guys had all over the world that were never captured on film.
Yeah. You know, Terry, when you walked out of that ring, you had that feeling that we got them tonight, though. I mean, you have that sense of pride when you're walking out of that ring, you know, both of you.
Yeah. And you know, and it's nice because, I mean, all my children were born, you know, way after the fact. And my youngest twins are 13-year-old boy, girl twins. And they go with me to, you know, these nostalgia events and stuff. And you know, it's got to be mind-boggling for them because they've never known me anyway, but the way they know me now. and they look at these images of, you know, this monster, because, you know, for them to see me, you know, 240 pounds, you know, with blood flying everywhere and, you know, fisticuffs and all the brutality of it, has got to be, you know, surreal for them.
Well, what do they think when they, what do they think when they watch on YouTube? Do they come down and make a comment when they pull up one of those matches, Dad, why, what was you thinking or anything like, cause I know my boys, both of my boys, you know, weren't born until after, you know, until I was doing my goofy stuff, you know, which I always do. But do they
the goofy stuff isn't the work. The serious Briscoe's the work.
Thank you, John.
Yeah, I think the boys look at it with a different sense of kind of, you know, like a pride kind of thing. And my daughter, I think it's kind of still a little scary too, because they don't want to think of me being able to be that violent. It's hard to imagine, but I think, you know, for boys that are competitive and athletes and whatnot, they've still got to say, you know, I came out of a good gene pool anyway, because my pops used to be able to, you know, lay it down pretty good.
Terry, you brought up something that was really interesting. You know, you talk about having an incredible match that's not filmed. I remember in a tour one time down in Mexico, I was working, and all of a sudden one night I walked out and I thought, that's the best match I could ever wrestle. And when you walk out, you don't know when it's going to happen. And you don't always know during the match that it's going to be a masterpiece, but sometimes it is. And then sometimes you go out the next night and you say, we're going to do it again, and it fails. Which happened to us. You know, it's just the craziest thing that every night is different in front of fans. And that's why it's so important to have the ability to be able to listen to the fans. You know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But that's that adrenaline that you talk about, that when you get it right, you don't give a damn if there's five people there or 5 million people there. You just did the best you could possibly do at your art. And that's like mainline drugs.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, stand in the middle of, you know, 20, 30,000 people, and they're so loud that it goes quiet, that it's so loud that all of a sudden you can hear stuff going on in your head, and you're like in another world, and it's like totally surreal. I mean, that is nothing I've ever been able to duplicate in anything that I've ever done in my entire life, as far as a satisfaction type, you know, feeling for doing something. And you know, I talked to different people that are different lines of work and do different things. And I say, you know, performing is such a blessing. You're so to develop a gift, do it, get paid crazy amounts of money to do it, get this notoriety and whatnot. But to experience that with so many people that it did, it impacted them for 20, 30 years. You made them feel a certain way that they can remember 30 years later how it made them feel. And they were sitting there with their grandpa or their grandma, or, you know, or watching it on TV on Saturday nights. It brings back all these memories because you made them feel a certain way because something you did that you loved.
How does it make you feel when one of these kids come up, you know, real little, you know, about 10 to 12 years old and say, Terry, Mr. Magnum, you were my granddaddy's favorite wrestler, or my grandma. My grandma loved you.
And I love it. And I mean, you know, my earliest memories of television, about 7, 8 years old, were watching Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling with my dad. And I watched Wahoo and Johnny Valentine beat the crap out of each other in that silver, that goldfish bowl full of silver dollars.
Right. Right.
You know, and those are the memories that I have from growing up. So to go from there to a little skinny kid in the eighth grade to a state champion in 1977 to selling out Norfolk Scope with Ric Flair for the World's Heavyweight Championship in 1985 is kind of crazy.
Well, let's talk about that. Okay. With Flair, I mean, Terry, I mean, you were being groomed. Did you have conversations with Jimmy or Dusty or any of those guys during this program that, Terry, you know, we're going to set a date. You're going to be the next champion. How close were you to knowing that was your next step?
Jimmy and Dusty and I flew to New York just for like an evening out. And they told me that the whole committee had voted. and they had approved it. And it was that close.
What year was that?
And this was 1986. And they were looking, they were just looking at the platform, because this will blow your mind. And I'm not saying anything out of school, because Rick knows this. They wanted a young champion. They looked at Rick, who's 10 years older than me. I was 27. He was 37. They wanted him to be like the Jack Nicklaus kind of persona in, you know, which would have never flown. He'd have left and gone to WWE, you know, in a skinny minute, because he's Ric Flair. But their idea was to shift, and they wanted a youth movement. They, you know, they knew where they wanted to go with it. They had it all planned out, all figured out, and they wanted to change the face of the company. So that's what they were grooming me for. That's what was set. And it was, you know, I didn't have a date, but you know, I suspect it would have happened in 86.
You were in a program with Tully at the time, or
I was in a program with Jimmy Garvin. So I was in a cool off. I was in a cool off program with Jimmy after the Best of Seven series with Nikita, and then I was going to go back to Flair.
Was that in a time? So you had, I guess, one or two WrestleManias at that time. I guess the first WrestleMania was in 85. So Vince was just starting to put the mega shows together. The territories were just starting to put the super clashes together. Was this in response to Vince, or was this just a matter of business that, hey, we want to move forward with Magnum TA, or was it a little bit of both?
Well, basically, they had, you know, Jimmy had said as much when I was in Louisiana. When I was in Mid-South. I mean, he told me I could have anything I wanted. And I had never made any bones about the fact that I wanted to be the best in the world. And back then, when it was the 10 pounds of gold before the big gold belt, that belt was something. It meant something. The belt that Jack carried, Harley carried, Dusty carried, you know, Dory. I mean, that belt meant something in the lineage. And it was a shoot, because you got 10% at the gate. The world champion got a 10% payoff out of the gate. 3% went to the NWA. That was part of their whole reason that the 10 pounds of gold belt went away and the big gold belt was made, because it wasn't any longer the NWA World Heavyweight Champion, even though they alluded to that. When the 10 pounds of gold went away, they stopped paying out all that money.
They stopped paying that 13%. Yeah, they stopped paying that 13%, the 3% to end up being a 10% to the champion, you know, man. And the guys used to get, well, I know, speaking from Jack's standpoint, you know, when he had to go, he'd made a shot in Richmond, Virginia, and we took him to D.C. He caught a nonstop flight to Tokyo, defended the belt that night, had to give up 3%. He told Sam, screw yourself. I'm keeping all, and he kept all the money. Then he flew all the way back to St. Louis the next night and wrestled another hour, you know, that's, you know, and give up that 3%, you know. And plus the promoters, I mean, Fritz, that's the reason Fritz didn't bring the champion in a lot, or even Bosch, you know, because Fritz didn't want to pay that 13% and then give up that 3% to the NWA. He didn't feel like they deserved it for anything.
Yeah, John, they launched TBS is what took the Crockett's off, all right? They made the deal because Vince got off, went to USA. We took over that show. They put Flair and I together for a marquee to take all the way around the country to show our product. Dusty used to call it the pride in our product. Flair and I did 19-hour Broadways in 1 month.
Wow.
19. Wow. 1 month.
Wow.
Flair had his first $100,000 month with me.
Wow.
Going around doing that. I mean, Three Rivers Stadium in a hailstorm. I mean, did it all. It didn't matter where it was. We did the hour all the way around the entire loop. And that's how we established the product the NWA was bringing, to have something markedly different than the entertainment side that the WWE was enjoying, you know, such success with Hogan and the colorful things that they were doing. So we were trying, we were going in the same towns and the same nights and selling out two different buildings. WWE over here, we are over there, and we're both selling out. I mean, how many wrestling fans are there? You know, it's crazy, right?
It was hot in those days. And at that time, you had to know, you know, that you had the ability, Terry, to carry that 10 pound of gold and carry it with class.
Well, thank you. And that means a lot coming from you, I will say, because I'll be honest. I really felt like I was ready after the program with Nikita, for the simple fact I had always been the listener. Always, I'd never been the general till I had the program with Nikita, because Tully was, you know, such a hand. Right. I mean, we didn't talk that much anyway, but with Rick or Ted DiBiase or, you know, guys I worked with that were great talents over the years, they generaled the match. Right. So when I got the program with Nikita, who had only been in the business a very short time, and we had a very successful program and we tore the house down, I said, if I can do it with this monster and I'm the one generaling it, then I'm ready. I can do it.
What did you think about the WWE product at the time? I mean, did you think it was just more show business and you wanted to stay where the NWA was, I guess, considered more athleticism and more wrestling style? Did you ever consider jumping to WWE, and did you ever have talks with Vince?
I never had a talk with Vince until after the accident. Never met him, never talked to him. And be honest, I was such a loyal, diehard NWA driven in my bones from Eddie, you know, all the way through, that was, you know, that was just the benchmark. Now, had I seen the business floundering, the model changing, you know, realizing that they weren't keeping up with the times, weren't expanding the business, you know, things that had gone on, I'm not saying I wouldn't have had that conversation, because I loved everything they did in the Attitude Era that I watched. I mean, I thought that was, you know, took intensity to a whole new level. I mean, I as a matter of fact, the guys at Wrestling Tees got a shirt. I told them, Omega says, Magnum TA, Attitude Before the Era, because I was so comfortable in that role that it was, I would have been made for it. It wouldn't have been a stretch. And Shawn Michaels was driving me around when I was the U.S. champ, you know, back in the day when I came to San Antonio.
Oh, really?
I would have loved to work with Sean and, you know, and Brett and yourself and, you know, different guys. I mean, I'm 61 years old. I had this accident at 27. I missed, you know, easily a 10 years of prime performance, but also feel like I never looked bad in a set of tights. So I didn't feel like I had to go out and say, well, you know, am I too old to do this or not? So at least I got remembered in my prime.
And you still look pretty damn good for 61 years old, the old fart.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Jerry's having surgery this week, and I have a feeling that finally I'm getting a chance to take him down. I don't have a good record against Jerry, but he's having some surgery this week, and I'm flying down to Florida, and I'm gonna take the shirt from him. I'm going to. Oh.
Well, good luck with that.
What was the call you had with Vince? You say you mentioned the call with Vince after the accident. What was the call with Vince about?
Well, it was actually a face to face. The historic event when Benoit had his catastrophic end. I was at that pay per view that he was supposed to be at that he didn't show up. The pay per view was in Houston, Texas, I think, and they had all these champions from different whatever, you know, there and. And we just talked for a few minutes, and he said what a shame it was because we would have made so much money together.
Oh, Jerry, can you imagine Magnum TA against Brett or Magnum TA against Sean?
Especially when he was just saying about Sean driving him around, I can just imagine, you know, the matches, you know, the intensity that Terry would have brought up there. I mean, he would have brought that rugged style, and it would have made a completely different Shawn Michaels, I believe, and a completely different Bret Hart. And I can only visualize and have wonderment smile on my face knowing the results of those matches.
Well, I'll tell you a quick story, Sean, and something happened to me and something I passed on to Sean. When I was in San Antonio, a young guy named that became Hercules Hernandez comes in.
Ray.
Ray's got a grocery bag, like an old timey big brown bag, full of performance enhancing stuff.
No. I mean,
spilling over. So Ray weighed about 216 at the time, and I was still about 230. I was not quite as big as I ended up staying. But so Ray and I start working out together and sharing his grocery bag. And I went up to 270, and Ray, I don't know where he just started like looking like he was going to explode. But I walked into a dressing room and Bruiser Brody was there. He said, "Kid, you're looking great." He said, "But I got to tell you something." He said, "If you become a star based on the way you look, and you've got to do what you're doing now to maintain that 12 months out of the year, you've written your own epitaph."
Wow.
And a light bulb went off, and I said, "Hey, I'm going to find a happy medium, a place that I can sustain a size that I'm happy with. I'm going to learn my trade. I'm going to learn to work. I'm just going to be the best version of me I can be, not because I'm all jacked up on the juice. Not going to do it." Change. Gear went off. Same thing with Sean. So I see Sean in Flair's personal gym after my accident. I'm over at Flair's house, and Sean's in there working, and he's pumping up, and he's trying to get big. And I told Sean, I said, "Look, my friend," I said, "it's an illusion. It's what you look like you can do, not what you can do." I said, "Find a happy spot. Find something you can do. Get as cut and ripped as you can get, and be healthy, and you'll have a long career. You'd be good." Because he was like trying to get all, he was wanting to get all pumped up and get big. I said, "It will do you in." And I watched him. He wore the long pants because he didn't have the biggest legs in the world, but he had good shape. And, you know, he'd do his little double bicep thing. But Sean was just a size that he could perform. He could go 60 minutes. He could do whatever he wanted to do. And that was the same model that I based myself on. And when I saw Bruiser Brody's, wife in Iowa, I was telling her the story because, I mean, I wanted to be the Road Warriors back then. I was going to go to 300 pounds. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. But I'd probably, been in the ground in 4 or 5 years down the road, like so many of my contemporaries, mixing all that stuff together and drinking like a fish. I didn't do it. And you couldn't be the kind of performer I wanted to be. I mean, I wanted to be able to go 60 minutes, 90 minutes, tear the house down, not get blown up. I have not one time in my life, in my career, even when I first started, got sick in the ring, been one of those guys that had to roll in the ring and throw up. I mean, I was always about conditioning because I wanted to perform and give the best I could give. And you can't be 300 pounds and perform the way that we did, back then. You can't go 90 miles an hour and hard hitting up and down, back and forth, fighting from the bottom, blood, guts, and gore. And be jacked to the moon on the sauce. This can't.
Terry, why after your accident, you did some commentary. You're a very smart guy. You're very articulate. You probably could have had a career in commentary for as long as you wanted or some type of authority figure. You did a little bit of an angle later for Dusty and created the Midnight Rider. Your accident created a lot of things. You created the superpowers. You created Nikita. You created Dusty. You didn't create Dusty, but you certainly helped the superpowers get going. Why did you not stay with the business after that?
Couple things. First of all, the family that I had grown so tight with, the Crocketts and with Dusty, when they sold the business to Turner and a group of corporate people came in and took it over, it was like I was with a bunch of strangers. There was no loyalty, there was no respect. It was the most uncomfortable feeling atmosphere I've ever been in my life. It's like the old story of the guys that bought Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus because they had the money, but they had no idea how to run the circus. TBS knew this was the greatest product going, and it had made their station and their brand through the hard times. So they thought owning it would be great, but they had no idea what to do with it. You hire, Jim Herd to come in and run it, and he hasn't got a clue. So my passion was I wanted to be able to teach people. And still, I've forgotten more about psychology than most people that are, doing it today could think of. But the thing of it is, I wasn't around people that were passionate about it like I was. So I didn't have the vehicle to, I'm 28, 29 years old. It's not like I'm an old guy, retired, sitting around talking about what used to be. I should have been out there, you know, doing it. But you got guys that are, you know, on $350,000, $400,000, $500,000 contracts looking at me like, what am I going to tell them about how to do something, right? They didn't have the respect because they were making so much money. Therefore, somebody thought so much of them that what could somebody, you know, teach them about doing it? And, you know, we had Sting and Lex Luger and, you know, all these young guys that were, you know, out there doing their thing, but I wasn't part of the machine. And I will say this, when I went and did that event for Vince, and I just sat back and Flair was over somewhere and Jim Ross was over somewhere, and it felt like home, you know, just sitting there before the event with the guys walking around and stuff. There, I have never done anything in my life since, nor will I probably ever again, where that community of people, you know, is like a family. Whether, and it's not because we've driven up and down the road together, it's because we all share this same bond. It's like being in the biggest fraternity in the world. Whether they go, you know, work through every step of the match that they do or not, we're all cut out of the same sheet of cloth at the end of the day. I put a few bricks in that road that John Cena, you know, went and built a skyscraper on. And, you know, I'm glad to have been a part of it. I'm not envious. I wouldn't trade anything for the world. And I'd rather look back on something that's still relevant today, 35 years later, than, you know, somebody trying to remember something special about me after a career that had drug out way too long and way past my prime and didn't get to remember me in the light that, you know, that I would like to be remembered in.
You mentioned that fraternity. It's something that Jerry and I talk about quite a bit. You know, we were just sitting around BSing and talking to each other, and somebody said, hey, why don't you put that on a podcast? I said, well, I don't know if anybody wants to listen to it. And Jerry said, well, we'll enjoy it, and we do. You know what? This is one of the most fun hours we get to do every week. I've never met you before in person. We're actually on Zoom right now, which is
– Well, you know what? You have, and you don't remember, but I'm going to tell you. So I met you here in Charlotte. Dusty was there backstage. And I'll tell you how you remember it. You had hunting permits. You had hunting permits you were handing out. Think back. Ayatollah Khomeini and all back in the day.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
I got one of those.
I do remember.
Yes. So I knew if I told you the hunting permit story.
That's right. I do remember. Because I kept racking my brain thinking, I'm sure I've run into Magnum before. I have. And that's exactly right.
Yeah.
Oh, we had some fun backstage. People don't realize the backstage stuff is that's one of the things I miss most about the business. You can't get over performing in the ring, but the backstage banter and the silliness that went on backstage, like those hunting permits, was just priceless.
Just total silliness that goes on back there. I mean, we're all intense people. When that music hits and that bell rings, I mean, the intensity comes on, and you gotta keep that intensity. A lot of fans don't realize how difficult that is for you to go out there and keep that intensity going and everything. That's the reason I'm respecting these young guys so much, because they're doing it in front of no people now, Terry. And, you know, I mean, we didn't have a lot of people in some of our TV taping, but there's zero people there, and they're learning by feel now. And I think once this thing is over and if thousands of people are in the arena, these kids are all going to be better because of this experience working with no people. And then boom, all of a sudden they got a full audience out there, and they'll be able to feel that adrenaline like we have.
Yeah, they will. They will. And I, you know, I think we're going to see that in the next 8 to 10 months. I think we'll see that again.
Well, I want to tell you this, Terry, coming from a guy that's seen you from the beginning, and you and I became friends, you know, right away. You know, we had a lot in common with amateur wrestling, and you know, coming up with Eddie, and we became friends. We've stayed friends. But you know what, like I said at the very beginning, when I first saw you in the ring in Florida. Man, you were good, and Jack and I, you know, you travel with us. We heard your philosophy. We heard your desire. We'd talk. I mean, this kid's going to be the real deal down the line. You didn't disappoint. You carried out everything that we'd ever hoped for you, and you had one wonderful career, and man, I'm proud to be your friend, and I was so proud of you when you came to Waterloo and you got to meet Dan Gable and share that experience with him. And John was inducted up in the same Hall of Fame, and so you guys are brothers like that. And you know, one of these days, all three of us are going to be able to get together, and we'll might challenge you for that damn leader.
Well, I might be up for it. You just never know.
Terry, it's a tremendous honor. It really is. I've been looking forward to this for quite some time. Thank you for joining us.
It is my pleasure. Thank you, gentlemen.